Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Emily Bida, author of this, her first novel, The Body Double, published last month by Doubleday. Emily has been the author of the popular advice column Dear Glutton for the past few years in the Austin Chronicle. Her articles are online at the paper, which are they're really fun to read. So Austin natives have a great resource in Emily's reviews and suggestions, and it'd be great if I was in Austin. And as I said, The Body Double is her first novel. So The Body Double explores identity, its loss, its regaining. In part, the transformation of our protagonist is a dream come true. In part, it's not a nightmare, but a blurred, confusing, and even treacherous process. So because we have a narrator who is not necessarily unreliable, and a second supporting star who definitely is kind of interiorly, we're constantly taking guesses as the reader, thinking, you know, what is really going on, which is, you know, the best kind of read there is. So we are as intimately involved in Rosanna and Max as the author is and as the characters themselves are. So I'll try very hard in this interview not to mention or extort spoilers, but it's going to be hard. So trust me.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So trust me, this is a book that you should read, not only for your questions as you read, but the questions that remain after you put the book down, probably after you've read it in one sitting. Or laying, as I did. So, welcome, Emily, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me, and thank you for that incredibly flattering introduction. I think I've just
no, I really enjoyed
the fire from blushing so hard. Thank you.
Well, the good thing about doing the show is that Rebecca, my producer, gets so many books that I probably wouldn't pick up because, as you might know, I have an independent bookstore, and everyone judges a book by its cover, and it's a great cover. But publishers are looking for a specific target audience, and so they always like having girls and women on the cover who are somewhat hidden. And that's what yours is like, but it's really cool. Did you get a chance to vet that?
Yeah, I did, actually. I worked pretty closely with the designer, who is the amazing Emily. I just forgot her last name as soon as I started saying it, but she's really incredible and has designed a lot of books that I really admire, and her style is so distinctive. And she had the idea of creating like a really beachy, fun sort of California vibe with all those colors like the pinks and the blues, and it's very cheerful. But then you have this obscuring swipe that covers the face of the model. So it adds this kind of layer of, ambiguity that I thought was so interesting.
Actually,
I just love the cover.
Yeah, me too. And it's funny because it's almost scary, but almost scary. You know, it's not like scary, scary. And that's what I think is so cool about it. Who's the woman? Who's the woman behind the splotch?
You know what the amazing thing is I have no idea, and I've actually never seen her full face.
Huh. That's
which amazing. I really love. So I think she's just a stock photo. I mean, no just about it. She's a hardworking stock photo model. And I think that's like kind of the perfect person to represent this book, somebody that their whole job is their face and their body and, you know, like this their appearance, but then at the same time is anonymous.
And which is exactly why our protagonist is anonymous. She has no name.
Yeah, exactly.
So, totally aside, what is it about food, both in your work and in this book, that's so exciting and important for you? Because the dinner is so, you've prepared the dinner in the book as if you were the hostess of the dinner, even the seating.
Well, I mean, in a way I am, right?
You are.
Whoever is reading the book, like, please, you're welcome to my table. So... I just love the connection between food and community. I grew up reading a lot of amazing food writers. Like when I was younger, I'd always read a lot of Jonathan Gold for fun. I would love to read like MFK Fisher and R.W. Apple and just these amazing writers that create a narrative around food. And for me, food is so interesting because it's one of the most basic shared parts of the human experience. Like we all have different emotional realities. We all, you know, grow up from whatever, but we all have to so much about both who someone is and who they want to be. based on the sort of aspirational nature of like what they're putting in their body or what they're sharing with others. And I think that's something that I was really interested in the book, is that, you know, our narrator is essentially trying to become this other person. And what better way to do that than to control the things that you put into your body and to make sure that they're different from anything that you would sort of put into your body under your own auspices, you know?
Well, yeah, and actually that's a good segue into, since we're trying to sell your book, it's a good segue into, like, you know, giving us a brief summary, because sometimes I just go astray, a brief summary of who Rosanna and Rosanna are and kind of what the book is about, I guess.
I love that you're saying Rosanna and Rosanna. That's such a neat way of getting around the fact that she's never named. That's a really clever way of doing it. I'm going to have to steal that from you. So I guess the elevator pitch, the super short summary of the book, is that it's about this young woman who is sort of plucked from inauspicious circumstances to become the body double of this reclusive actress, and she slowly ends up taking over her life.
Okay, let me ask you specific questions then. Tell us how she gets recruited, because it's kind of interesting. It should be interesting. How does she get recruited as the one who's going to be the Pygmalion?
Yeah, that is such a creepy scene, isn't it?
Yeah.
I feel like that's something that I was really interested in writing this book, is the idea of surveillance and the idea that even somebody who thinks themselves anonymous, like this girl doesn't really have a social media presence. She's someone that doesn't have a lot of family, a lot of community support. She considers herself pretty anonymous, but she's still seen by the people that need her. And so she's discovered basically through her manager at her job where she works at this theater, via an online search. And so even though she's not trying to participate in this machinery of like discovery and commodifying her body, that choice is made for her. And she's sort of plucked from obscurity and placed into this role without asking for it. I mean, of course, once she's there, she really hits the ground running, like she's in. But it's not a choice, you know?
Yeah, but the thing is that when the reader first... The thing is, you become so, not intimate, but yeah, intimate with the protagonist, because you draw her so quickly and so well. It's like she wins the lottery. You know, at first, it's like she wins the lottery, which is a good...
Absolutely.
You know, it's an incredible setup, especially where... Well, I won't say anything else.
I know.
It's hard.
It's so hard because there's really... I think... do you know that Zen koan about what gives a bowl form is the absence at the center of the bowl, or what makes a wheel turn is the absence at the center of the wheel?
Yeah.
I feel like in a lot of ways this book is about absence, you know?
Yeah, negative space.
It's formed around what's not there.
Yeah, negative space is one of my favorite things, and that's what I strived for in my bookstore. It's hard to do. Everything gets cluttered up, you know?
Yeah. But that's just life.
Yeah, I know.
But yeah, exactly. I think that it does, when it comes to her, it does seem like sort of a dream. I mean, who hasn't wanted or wondered what it would be like to be rich or to be famous and to have all these little decisions of your life taken care of for you, you know?
Well, yeah, it's funny because briefly before we started the show, one of the questions we were talking about was, I asked you, you just said, who doesn't? So, okay, did you ever want that to happen to you? Would you ever fantasize about that?
You know, yes and no. I think on an actual real level, not really. I'm not somebody that's ever been particularly interested in fame or that world, despite, you know, growing up in Hollywood. But I think there are certain aspects of it that are really seductive. And one of those for me is the idea of just being absolutely taken care of. Because, like, when you're really famous, you don't have to think about anything, you know? You don't have to do grocery shopping. You don't have to worry about what you're wearing. You don't have to, like, don't have to make a single decision. Everything is taken care of you in this way that's very, almost very childlike. And I think, of course, there's something that's appealing about that, about just being off the hook for adulthood and just saying, like, you know, you're going to be taken care of in these small details. So you can focus on your art or your acting or your singing or whatever it is that makes you famous. Although I guess nowadays, a lot of the times, there's not really one thing. But there is something appealing about that, of course. I think especially as a writer, I think my fantasy isn't so much being famous, but just being able to live in like a remote lighthouse and not have to do anything but write books, which of course would be horrible in reality. I think I'd get very bored. But theoretically, the idea of not having to worry about anything but the work that you care about is super seductive, yeah.
And that's another good segue, because the juxtaposition between where she lives in this transition period is, I didn't expect that to be where she was going to be living when I first, when she was on the plane. I didn't expect, and she didn't either, to expect to go to that place. And then the transformation and the way you handled it is really, and this is what I was saying at the beginning, and what I'm saying, you know, and I have a bookstore, the book's on the front, you know, my people will know. And so, like, the transformation, you know, it's a combination of, you know, exterior, whether it's the makeup, the clothes, whether it's the magazines, whether it's the videos, you know, there's that one part, and then there's this internal part that, you know, Max controls, this is also going towards spoiler territory, controls up to a certain point. So talk about how you came up with the ability to do that transformation, including the plastic surgery.
That's really an interesting question. I mean, the first thing I think is the apartment, which there's an interesting kind of footnote to that, which is that those apartments are based on real apartments in the Hollywood Hills here. I mean, not like one specific building necessarily, but yeah, in the, I guess 1920s, there was this group called the Philosophical Research Society, and they owned all these giant mansions in the Hollywood Hills that, rumor has it, were connected by secret passage. And they also had a bunch of apartment buildings where the people that worked in these mansions would live. And again, like I said, rumor has it, they were connected by secret passages to the houses of, like, the big stars of the day. So that idea that there would be these two structures that are, you know, the same, basically the same structure, they share this hallway, they're built by the same person, but they're so completely different.
Yeah, and that's how
that really appealed to me.
And that's how the characters start out too.
Yeah, exactly. That she thinks she's going to be dropped into this, like, Barbie dream house, but instead she's basically, she is essentially an employee. You know, she both is this person and is not this person.
And it's,
and
go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was just going to say, I was really interested in exploring that tension, you know, between what you think this experience is going to be like and then what it actually is. And I think that, in a sense, everything that comes after, like you said, all the physical details of her transformation, but then also some of the psychological sort of machinations and manipulation that goes on between her and Max, I think a lot of that is about her wanting to transform her reality into the ideal that she is being presented as to the public, you know?
Yeah.
Like, wouldn't it be better if she actually was this person and she had their power?
Well, again,
well, yes and no, yeah.
She, in some ways, I'll just go out a little bit on a limb, in some ways she becomes a better Rosanna than Rosanna. And
yeah.
And it's really funny because I was thinking about, like, I guess I was watching infomercials or something, and Christie Brinkley's on one now. And you really don't know what Christie Brinkley looks like. We don't know what she looks like. You know, she's selling the stuff, and she's supposed to be beautiful, and she's 54 or whatever. And in the pictures, she looks like she's 30. But you don't know what she looks like. You don't know what Jennifer Lawrence looks like.
No, of course.
And that's a big part of the book, because she's able to do something that seems almost miraculous. And then I thought about it, and I said, I guess it could be done.
Yeah, because, I mean, when you think about it, so much of life is performance, you know? I mean, if we're going back to Zen Koans again, there's that famous Japanese saying about the different masks that you wear, and how you have a mask that's for the public, and you have a mask that's for people you're close to, and then you even have one for yourself. And I do think that that's true. I think that there's a certain aspect of performance that's needed to create the sort of replicatable self, you know?
Yes.
Like, no one is entirely consistent, and yet the vision of ourselves that we have to present to the world does have to have a certain amount of consistency. And so in a way, wouldn't it be easier to just have those rules placed before you to say, this is what you're like, this is the person you are, this is who everyone expects you to be, do it, and you'll be rewarded, you know?
Right. It's like there's the person you think you look like, there's the way other people think you look like, and then there's what you really look like.
Yeah, exactly. Or like how you never really see your own face. You know, you only can see a reflection. You never,
yeah,
we don't really know.
Which is like the
how
world.
How you create others.
It's like TikTok, you know, everything's backwards.
Yeah.
Why don't they just flip it, you know? Why just flip it so you can read the letters? It's so silly. But I guess that's part of the whole schema of TikTok, is that everybody does the same thing and you don't want to change what everybody else is doing in the moment. You know, it's funny. It's totally off the topic, but I've interviewed both Karen Russell and Ivy Pechota. And you give
two
such,
of my absolute favorite people in the world. So congratulations to you.
Oh, yeah. They were just, both of them were lovely. I think it was at Swamp.
Yeah, they're both incredible, incredible women. And they've both just been, I'm really lucky that they've both been mentors to me, you know, through the early stages of my career. And, you know, Ivy actually, funnily enough, this book started out, well, it started off as a piece of flash fiction. It wasn't working, so I tried to turn it into a short story. And Ivy was the first person to read that story.
Wow.
So years later.
That's,
I know, if it wasn't for Ivy.
Well, it's like with Karen, it's so funny because I think it was for Swamplandia, and I think she was writer in residence at Bard or something, maybe. And it's so funny, in our interview, you know, you were talking about how my interviews are different. We ended up, I guess I can say this because she did say it. We ended up deciding that she was going to run. She just had come up from Florida and she didn't understand snow and ice and how to wipe off her windshield and how she was sliding down the roads. And I said, you know,
I relate to that. Yeah.
She goes, why? I said, while you're at it, why don't you just casually hit the other writers that you're competing with? And she goes, that's a great idea. I should just wipe all of them out. And then, you know, so we had a great time. And then we ended up not.
Only Karen could get away with making that joke because, you know, in reality, she would just be there, like, supporting everyone, you know, baking them cookies or whatever.
Well, right. And, I, you know, like, I even asked her, I said, so what are you doing right now? She goes, well, I'm just kind of laying on the couch in my pajamas and I'm eating potato chips. You know, it's like, hey, so what are you doing right
Karen,
now? What are you doing
what
right
am
now?
I doing right now? Actually, you know, my mom is a midwife, and she was on a birth last night. So I am at her house baking bread for her childbirth education classes that she has.
Cool.
Or sorry, for her mother's groups. So I'm like walking around in the garden waiting for this bread to be ready.
Oh, that's nice. That's nice.
Yeah, it's pretty beautiful, actually.
It's really interesting what you did with. I mean, all the characters are so well drawn. Not just Max, but if you talk about Leo, who really gets to the skin and beyond of Rosanna's transformation.
Oh, God, yeah.
So I can say that to you.
Yeah.
You know, and even Eleanor, even Holly, and then the young guy at the
Thank
dinner.
You.
They're all so well-drawn. You know, when I remember names from a book, I know it's a good
book. I was going to say, how do you remember all these people?
Because you wrote it well. Because I know Leo because you can when that scene when he's drunk and he discovers a truth.
Something.
Yeah, he discovers.
He won't say what.
Yeah, he discovers something. I would never
it's
say
really,
that.
Don't you kind of feel sorry for him?
Yeah,
you know,
because
I think it's so easy to make him into a villain, but really, like, wow, we're witnessing this person getting their heart broken in a really terrible way.
Yeah, I know, and it's, you know, these things can happen. That's the other thing about life, is these things can happen very easily.
Yeah, and I mean, who among us, again, this is obviously in some ways a very far-fetched situation, but who among us has not had that really heartbreaking moment of realization that somebody we love and somebody that we thought we knew was not that person and maybe never has been, you know?
Yeah, or else the other thing is, well, like especially in today's world with Trump, I mean, I've interviewed authors for 9 years and not one person, not one author has ever said one nice thing about Trump. And I realized, why is that? There must be some. Then I realized, because authors are intelligent. So they couldn't possibly think anything good about Trump. So this is what happens.
You know what? I will say I'm not a Trump person at all, but I will say as a fictional character, I think he'd be really interesting. I think in like maybe, you know, 50 years or something, somebody can write a ragtime about President Trump and that would be a really good book.
I don't know.
That's the nicest thing I can say about him.
Well, he's writing it right now. That's the problem. That's why Saturday Night Live, you get to a point where you can't parody someone. It's impossible.
Oh, yeah. I know.
And that's, as a novelist, yeah, you know that. Yeah, so Leo, yeah, I've been in this situation where I've been in the middle of something. This is what led to Trump. And I'm saying something that I know is right, that I know is true, and nobody believes me because they don't have the specific knowledge I have at that time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then Rosanna's Rosanna wrote, and then Rosanna goes home and she corrects the situation that gave rise to the confusion in the first place. How's that for avoiding a spoiler?
Yeah. Well, that was really artfully done. It's true. But I mean, that's so interesting. I hadn't really thought about the connection between, because obviously when I was in the early days of writing this, Trump hadn't been elected, or I guess maybe he had, but we hadn't had the same widespread negation of fact that's happening now, you know?
Yeah. Even today. Even today, he said that.
Oh God! What happened today?
He goes. A vaccine is very close for the coronavirus, and then his staff immediately, how they untweet his tweets. They go. He meant the Ebola virus, and it's like.
What?
And you know, I've given up saying you couldn't make this stuff up because we're so far beyond that.
Right now.
So anyway, but we got to sell your book. What am I doing? This is stupid.
Well, you know, maybe that'll help. Who knows?
I don't know. Yeah,
you'd be surprised it works.
if anyone's listening, yes. Hopefully they are. Sorry. So Max is almost like, if this was a movie, which it may very well be.
Yeah. Well, if Amazon has anything to say about it, hopefully.
I mean, it's so cinematic, and I mean, it would be. See, what happens now is with Amazon, Netflix, and Hulu and all, it's the perfect miniseries. You don't have to make a movie out of it.
Actually been optioned by Amazon.
I assumed.
Yeah. Which is really exciting. So I'm very curious to see what they're going to do with it.
Wasn't it interesting that it's, you know, Body Double was a movie? Did you ever see that movie by Brian De Palma?
You know, I didn't, and I actually hadn't heard of it until. This book was originally called something else. It was originally called The Reality Artist.
Mm-hmm.
And Jenny, my editor, wanted a different title just because she wanted something a little, you know, easier to say, a little catchier, maybe easier to understand. And that was just one of the options we came up with.
Well,
I had no idea that it was something else.
You should watch
it. And I Googled it later. I was like, oh.
Well, definitely watch it because there are some parallels. Not
That's interesting.
Directly, but. You can. There's like this cracked mirror reflection between your book and that movie.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting. Once you start looking, it's kind of amazing how many doubles there are in popular fiction.
Yeah, doppelgangers everywhere.
I mean, yeah, the doppelgangers from Shakespeare on. There's always people pretending to be other people and people dressing up as themselves, and you know, it's just an incredibly common cultural trope. And I think that's because, as people, we're so curious about the construction of identity, you know?
Yeah, and also it's like the construction of identity, because it's interesting that you made, let's see how I can say this without you, it's interesting how you made that little tiny flaw, because it's like the tapestries in medieval times where they had to include a slight imperfection somewhere in the tapestry, so it wasn't like they were trying to usurp the perfection of God.
Only God can make something perfect.
Yeah. So that's what happened with her. There's this, well, all right. Yeah.
Well,
that's
well,
not
she
really
has a flaw.
Yeah, she has a flaw. I can say that.
I agree.
So how did you know at the beginning, this is one of those Terry Gross questions which I don't ask. this is like, did you know at the beginning what was going to happen on those last three or four pages?
No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I think that something that, especially in the last three or four pages, I'm trying to think of how I can explain this without giving you too much away. Well, let's talk formally. There's a shift in POV there that for me really, really like nailed down what the ending was going to be. I think I was really struggling with how to make the ending work, because you need to get a sense of her shifting identity in that moment and like what she's arriving to. And I actually took this wonderful class with the writer Doug Dorst on POV. And we were like looking at all these different literary uses of point of view. And I'm trying to remember what story we read that used the third. I think it was the story Griffin by Charles Baxter.
Don't know the one.
That inspired it. It's a really good story. And he kind of uses like this collective voice that sort of had me thinking about like, well, what is her perspective in this moment when everything is changing? It can't be the same. You know, there has to be a change in voice to signal that you're arriving to this other place.
Yeah, it's like.
So that's what I was trying to do there.
it's like, you know, the idea of there's a gun in the first act, you know it's going to be fired in fifth act. And the thing is, at the beginning, you know, and this is okay, you know it's not going to be, you know it's not going to be what you think it's going to be. You kind of know
that.
Yeah,
exactly.
And then...
Well, yeah, because that wouldn't be a very interesting...
Well, you
if
do,
it was, you'd be a little disappointed, right?
Right. And that's why it's so cool, because after you read the book, you're still thinking, oh, well, wait a minute, did that, huh, I don't know. And then what's going to happen? So it's... But what I was going to say, because, you know... because of your fault, we're running out of time. So,
oh my God, sorry, I was just having too much fun chatting with you.
So anyway, what I was going to say was, the pivotal point to me in the book is when Marie says, I thought you thought he was kind of a creep.
Oh yeah, didn't your stomach just like drop?
Yep.
When you read that?
Yep. And then I go, okay. All right.
Oh yeah. But what's going on?
Yeah, I still didn't know, but that was good. That was good, because you know it's when you have one line like that, and then you also and you don't know about Marie either. You know, you're
not, absolutely. What's her skin in this game? Yeah.
I have no
idea.
Especially
when you see how much of her celebrity is sort of propped up by her association with Rosanna. You know.
Oh
about
yeah.
About how much press she gets when they're sort of reunited as these. Power friend group kind of a thing. What a horrifying thought to think that you can't trust the motives of anybody around you.
Which makes it easier for her. For example, in the interview, which you only have one, but in the interview, you know, you think, oh, maybe she's going to, it's not going to be what Max, you know, and all that. And then she becomes, and that's why he looks at her in the car like, what am I doing? Oh, I
what did I do? Yeah,
yeah. And it's like Pygmalion. And then, yeah. but she turns it all. She turns the tables on the interviewer, and the way that happens is another pivotal point, because you realize this is going to be a transformation. Like, no, yeah. What am I going to say?
Yeah,
no,
like an internal. And you know what? I think it really interested me in that scene. That. Kind of in the later part of the book where we see her taking a little bit more of control of the transformation is how she almost finds a way to empower herself and to stand up to people and kind of like claim her space through this identity, through this play acting. You know, you don't get the sense that the old girl, the old character, I guess, would have had that kind of interaction with anybody.
Never.
You know?
No. And
also somebody that had much more power over her or who was trying to present her image in a certain way. I don't think that she would have asserted that kind of control. But she's empowered by this act of transformation to basically step up and say, like, I am this person, you know?
And the other thing you did that was really cool, which was you gave it this backstory of our protagonist's family and family history. Which gave rise in part to the ability or frustration she had in the transformation, because her father and what her father did and those things, you know, definitely were very important. That was a good way of thinking up things too. Who knew you were going to do that?
Thank you. I think that that's something that really interests me, is the way that trauma informs, like, trying to think of a good way to describe this. But basically, the way that our trauma can inform the way that we interact with the people and what we expect from them, you know? Because obviously this person is incredibly traumatized.
Yeah.
And yet we don't really get a sense that she's dealt with her trauma. We don't really get a sense that, like, oh, she's had any kind of support in dealing with this terrible thing that happened in her family. And so instead she's sort of working to resolve it through her own behavior and through trying to assert control in these different ways, you know?
So Emily, like I said, I own this bookstore and this book is on our front table, and I've really, really enjoyed talking to you about it. And so let me tell everyone, we've been talking to Emily Beta, about The Body Double, her first book. And I wanted to just thank you for sharing your ideas and thoughts and telling the story to us. And it's been a pleasure talking to you today.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much for this wonderful conversation. It was so fun discussing these big questions with you. And thank you for operating an independent bookstore, my favorite kind of place in the world.
This my
cheers for you.
I'll never make any money, but it's Definitely passion.
I'm a novelist. I feel your pain.
We were speaking with Emily Bida, whose book The Body Double was published in March this month, and just a couple of weeks ago. The Body Double is a great book. It's just, you got to read it in one sitting, and it's like, you don't know what's going to happen, but you kind of know something's going to happen. That doesn't make any sense, really, but yeah, it's like, you know, like in the Hitchcockian sense, that something is going to happen that you didn't expect. You can guess, as in any mystery, but here there's a little more, what I would say, ineffable quality, that you're not quite sure that what you're thinking is where it's going at all. And then at the end, which I'm not going to tell you the end, obviously, it's something that you know, it's like you sit up and you're startled as if someone's actually there in the room with you. Great book. And then we have, some of the ones we have coming up are books that are right in my wheelhouse, like Donald Hoffman's going to discuss his latest, which is like The Case Against Reality, Why Evolution Hid the Truth from Our Eyes. And evolution does, in fact, do that. It hides the truth from our eyes. So the question is whether what we perceive exists, whether what we have to internalize regarding the external actually is what we think it is. Plus, there's so much more that we don't even receive. Anyway, without going off too much on that. And well, unfortunately, then is the philosopher and consciousness researcher, Philip Goff, who will discuss his latest book, which is Galileo's Error, Foundation for a New Science of Consciousness. So both of them bookend, literally and figuratively, this idea of reality and the idea of consciousness. Two things that go hand in hand. That is, does this exist and why am I aware of its existence? So that'll be great if you listen to my stuff, probably, and I hate listening to my stuff because I hate listening to my voice, but if you listen to my stuff, those would be two to listen to back to back because they essentially are two sides of the same coin. So in any event, enough of that. Thanks so much for joining us today for The Body Double. I highly recommend it. It's on the front table at our bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop in Exton. Hope you'll come out and join us. We can sit and have a cup of coffee together. And thanks for joining us virtually today. As we spoke to another great author, and we will next week. So look forward to seeing you back here again for a listen to The Avid Reader.